fare magari un po' di dibattito. Kim Cascone, musicista americano, italo-americano, keynote di Chef Festival, introdotto da Angelo Comino in Art Motor, anche lui musicista. Io lascio subito la parola ad Angelo.
Ok, grazie. Just want to say thank you for you coming to be here. I will try to be less intrusive as possible in order to leave more space, more time, because this precious things. But at the same time, probably I will make some kind of interference just to spice everything, hoping not to be offensive. And Kim Cascone is well known, maybe. I saw around some of the people in this space, in this room. I know them for really good taste and really underground music, so I'm really happy they are here. This is a good point for you. But at the same time, this is interesting for me because as a musician should do something on the stage, usually. But at the same time, not so many musicians think about what they are doing, what are the effects, what are the meaning of what they are doing. A lot of musicians, that's okay, but a lot of musicians just, okay, they like to play music. And sometimes this could be a limit. But at the same time, the people who think a lot about what they are thinking and doing risk to overdo things. Sometimes we do something that is too much aesthetics, too much conceived, and not so much music, maybe, or not so much understandable by the public itself. I think this is not the case of all guests, but we are discussing about this point, I think. So I will give you the microphone.
Thank you. I'm sorry I don't speak Italian. I was raised in an Italian household where my grandmother spoke Italian only to my father. It was a secret language, so I grew up always wondering what was being said. First, I'd like to thank the organizers, Simona, Luca, Luciana, for their hard work and for the invitation to be here. I'm deeply honored to be asked to provide this, or to share my ideas. About 3 or 4 months ago, a small publisher approached me and asked me if I'd be interested in writing a book. At first I said no, because I thought, well, what possibly do I have to share with the world right now? And then I started to think more about all the papers I've written in the past and some of the ideas that I've been developing now. And I had started writing short pieces, very short, maybe one page per piece, just very, like, microsound, but microtext. And I started thinking, well, what can I do? Because unfortunately, it's like having a hit song. You become well known for something, a paper that you've written or something. So everywhere I go, people say, yeah, oh, I love the aesthetics of failure. We use it in our curriculum, and my, you know, students love it. And it's great, but I've done so much since then. In the past 10 years, I've traveled all over the world and performed and conducted workshops and have lectured about various things. So I thought, well, here's my chance to kind of turn it on its head. And I flipped it, and I wanted to write something called The Failure of Aesthetics, because I've been very concerned about what's happening in electronic music and electroacoustic music as well. And let me just preface this by saying that my background is not in electronica so much as it is in music concrete and electroacoustic music. So that's the tradition which I come from. And in that tradition, performance is a variety of things, one of which is acousmatic presentation, which is being seated in the audience and diffusing a piece in the French, you know, music concrete kind of discipline. Anyway, so when I was asked to present here, I thought, well, this would be a very good chance to kind of try out, like sort of like a comedian trying out material on a new audience. So I have so far 17 observations of failure in sound art and glitch, and I'll just read from what I've been rewriting, rather, and if I get boring, just stop me. But the first piece is called The Sound of Money. In 1995, I received a call from the owner of a New Age record label in San Francisco. The label, a competitor of my label at the time, Silent Records, was trying to cross over from New Age music and capture some of the ambient techno market by marketing to children DJs and ambient producers. He invited me to his studios, where they were just finishing up mastering a new CD by a well-known New Age artist. The studio, equipped with every conceivable digital audio device, had a large state-of-the-art mixing board and a massive pair of studio monitors that could reproduce frequencies humans could never hear and cost more than 6 months of my salary. When I arrived, several engineers were busy twisting knobs on a rack of equalizers, trying to get the sound of the different reverb effects exactly right on the musician's CD release. After a tour of the studio and an explanation of how much each piece of gear cost, the label owner pushes play on the DAT machine, and we listen to a piece just mastered in the studio. After a few minutes of being bathed in glowing synths and shamanic drums slathered in thousands of dollars of reverb and surgically EQ'd such that each instrument had its own very frequency space, the owner turns to me and says, "That's what money sounds like." The bang that whimpered. The activity of glitch once held promise in revealing the internal contradictions of digital elitism to provide a platform on which critical discourse could take place and raise questions about our relationship to digital technologies. The digital domain, once the walled-off garden community of commercial entertainment, had been infiltrated by scruffy upstarts armed with consumer digital gear who sent the message that the exclusive club with the high-priced entry fee was quickly coming to an end. Taking the smooth exterior of digital audio and hacking it into harsh, sonic, pixelated ugliness, a handful of sound artists pulled back the veil of mystification and exposed and glorified the flaws inherent in digital technology, thereby subverting the very mechanisms which afforded the illusion of digital perfection which the elite digital classes had access to. This was the sonic equivalent of throwing red paint on an expensive fur worn by a rich patron of the arts posing for the paparazzi at some gallery opening. Glitch was much more than a style at first. It was the glint in the eye of the artistically mischievous and a warning shot across the bow of the digital elite. Glitch's fashion statement. Digital audio has been autopsied, explored, circuit bent, bit bent, subverted, beta tested, and played with until the chinks in the armor appeared. Quickly absorbed by the host body of Hollywood, Glitch was then fashioned into presets, plugins, and sample collections for the uber hipster digerati, those who claimed aesthetic hipness by proxy but lacked the time spent struggling on the plane of the sonic aesthetics. No matter what glitch artists could come up with in the morning, the digital industry would download it seconds later and enter it into the lexicon of sound design by that very afternoon. Today, glitch has become a permanent part of the arsenal of au courant stylistic sound and visual effects invoking edginess for many in opening credits of formulaic cyber sci-fi films. The tired, technology run-amok, gone-awry trope was given a new varnish and retooled for the internet age, where we are all now beta testers, bearing witness to our very own experiences of failure. As a result, glitch has become a fashion statement, detoothed for our safety, commodified for our entertainment consumption. The singularity of real-time as stasis. As machines get faster, creation via software approaches real-time. Hence, people now inhabit a state of total distraction, where there is less and less time to think or plan beforehand, much less stay focused on any task for more than a couple of minutes. We consistently hit the email send button without reading what we've written. This speed is what has distracted us from questioning or examining the politics of digital audio. We are pulled into a false real-time of Twitter tweets and Facebook posts, text messages, with our attention being multiplexed among dozens of external stimuli and tasks. We are speeding along at 48,000 samples per second, careening down a hill in a car with no brakes, unable to stop. At this speed, all looks like a blur as it whizzes past us. But in reality, all media is made up of single frames, or samples, or individual cells. Any movement perceived is an illusion, a trick of perceptual persistence. But we believe in this persistence as being real, and as a result, we have come to confuse this persistence with reality. This illusion has produced an era of achievement-oriented creation rather than a process-oriented one. The war drive. One afternoon, while driving my son home from school, I had the car radio tuned to National Public Radio, or NPR as we call it. As luck would have it, the topic of discussion was film sound, and the guest was an award-winning Hollywood sound designer, who, by the way, was someone I had worked with at Lucasfilm many years before. The host of the show asked the sound designer the usual questions about how he magically transformed ordinary, everyday sounds into shape-shifting monsters and warp-speed spaceships and dark, surreal backgrounds. Careful not to reveal too much, he offered some of the stock secrets of sound design, how he used pitch shifting, layering, and household items such as trash cans as acoustic processors. After dazzling the host with some of his gee whiz Hollywood anecdotes, he asked if he might pose a question to the audience. The sound designer suddenly shifted to a tone more appropriate for charity fundraising, and asked the amateur sound recordists in the audience to please contact him if they had recorded any unusual or interesting sounds. In exchange, of course, the amateur sound recordist would receive a screen credit. He explained that the demand for interesting sounds in Hollywood was so great that the small army of sound designers employed by Hollywood couldn't possibly supply them all, and hence needed to enlist the help of civilians armed with portable digital audio recorders. This reminded me of stories my father told me about growing up in New York City during World War II and being asked by the government to collect scrap metal for the war effort. This scrap metal was collected and brought to local storefronts set up by the government and later shipped to factories where it would be turned into warplanes and weapons. Is there really a shortage of interesting sounds in Hollywood? Or do they consider themselves at war with something or somebody? We are still pre-post. It is unfortunate that the post-digital has never gotten past the post part of its name. Like a car stuck in a snowbank, unable to move out of its rut, digital sound art has been spinning its wheels for some time now. Disposable cultural artifacts of fractal-like similarity are easily created, downloaded, and then tossed under the compost of popular culture. How many hard drives are sold simply to house the music collection so large the owner can never possibly listen to all of it in her lifetime. Derailed by a technology which has democratized the physical apparatus has only resulted in replacing musical praxis with gadget consumerism. Program or be programmed. A lack of intersection. Back in the early 2000s, I was asked to speak about a paper I'd written for the Computer Music Journal titled The Aesthetics of Failure, which I'd mentioned before. Seeing that most people understood failure as a stylistic effect in electronic music, I tried to explain that failure as a concept was much broader than just technological failure. That failure had to do more with the lack of intersection between a system's intended functional behavior and the end user's expected functional behavior. It was more than just an effect, I explained. It was a way of looking at and questioning our relationship with digital technology. I also explained how our cultural environments were constructed such that they reinforced these expectations in order to ensure steady consumption. Expectation fulfilled equals satisfaction. From our mediascape to the concert hall, our attentions were constantly being directed or programmed. And as a result, we were not taking our active participation in the production of meaning, but were simply running in the rut of expected or programmed behaviors. After many of the talks, I'd ask the audience for questions, and still people wanted to know about which software or plugins were best to create glitch or failure. I was dismayed by the lack of interest concerning the politics of digital audio or our aesthetic relationships to it. The tool is the message. When humans first started using tools, it was a heuristic endeavor. It took time and experimentation to arrive at an efficient solution to a particular problem. Our ancestors didn't have the benefit of leveraging other tools such as mathematics or physics to arrive more quickly at a solution for how best to move a boulder, how best to sharpen a spear for hunting, or how to cook food. Our ancestors' search for solutions in problem space was evolutionary, and it took a lot of time due to a lack of a framework within which to operate. Today, we have the benefit of many thousands of years of tool development to help us understand the underlying principles of how things work and how tools evolve. Today, we can build virtual models and test them in order to find out how they will behave well before they ever become real. Our tools have been built on the back of this long, long process of experimentation and evolution. But today, the majority of us rely on others to make our tools. For example, when a hole is dug and a fence post is cemented into place, no one thinks about what sort of shovel was used to make the fence. The action of the shovel is embedded in the task itself. It becomes part of the ensemble of tools that went into making the fence. So the tool itself recedes into the background and into the resultant structure. The physical action, labor, performed by a tool becomes a residual part of the fence. It is a component of the fabrication. By itself, it's important to the fence as relative, weighted, and most of the time, inconsequential, unless the hole was not dug properly or correctly. Why is it the tools we use to make sound art become the message itself rather than a residual part of a sound piece? The subliminal branding of electronic music. Around 2005, I was having dinner with a friend who's also a laptop musician and who's politically even further to the left than I am. We got around to trading war stories about touring, and I mentioned how I'd noticed how many laptop musicians who had been using Max MSP were then adopting Ableton Live for studio and stage. He glared at me and shook his head and announced that every single piece of electronic music created with Ableton Live is merely an advertising jingle for them, and worthless as anything containing lasting cultural value. He likened it to wearing clothing with the company's logo emblazoned across the front of it, rendering the wearer an unpaid walking advertisement. This is a new aspect of digital capitalism. All consumers are not only unpaid beta testers, but are also unknowingly unpaid advertisers when creating content. The medium is no longer the message. The logo has become the message. Famous in under 15 minutes. I was performing at an electronic music festival and had some time to kill, so I decided to check out some of the presentations and talks being given. Sandwiched in between two talks I was interested in attending, there was a demonstration scheduled of the new Ableton Live and Max for Live software, so I decided to stay for that. The demo was conducted by a local producer who was also a field representative for Ableton. Coming down with a cold, so. where did I stop? New features of the software were demonstrated and impressed everyone suitably. The presenter repeatedly used the term real-time while describing how fast one could produce a track. In order to demonstrate this real-time composition capability of the software, he set out to create a track within 15 minutes. While speedily creating this track, he pointed out how the tool was not getting in his way, and he was able to create by simply dragging clips into a session in real time and adjusting parameters to his liking, all in real time. Within 15 minutes, he had a passable down-tempo lounge piece that could have been playing in the lobby of some boutique hotel, similar to the one I had been staying. As we approach the speed of creating in real time, anything that gets in the way is designed out, discarded, or reduced, such that there is little thinking needed. Thinking gets in the way. Not too unlike cooking with whatever you find in your kitchen pantry and not paying any attention to recipes or whether or not your dinner guests would care for a dish made of lemon sherbet and hot pepper sauce. This aspect of creation in real time only serves to keep us distracted, steering us towards a culture of achievement rather than process. We're quickly becoming a seat-of-the-pants culture, churning out terabytes of content, little of which we'll ever get to listen to. Warhol's prediction of people becoming famous for 15 minutes has turned into people becoming famous in under 15 minutes. More songs about real time and music. I attended a conference in Poland recently where I was asked to speak about the role of the studio in electronic music, notably how composers have come to use it in their compositional praxis. There was a subtle implication in the premise that computer technology, i.e. laptops, had replaced actual studios. I pointed out that the studio had never really disappeared into the virtual realm via laptops and software, although many thought it had, that all one needed was a laptop to have a studio. I pointed out that although a laptop could embody many of the same functions as a recording studio with its virtual mixers and processors and tracks, that digital technology had changed the studio in one very important way. If we look at the process of creation of electronic music circa 1960, we see the following. From idea to marketplace, the compositional process has often followed a complex chain of technical assistants, engineers, and composers. The Radio Milano studio can serve as an example of this. As a result, the creative atmosphere was very process-oriented, and many pieces took a painstaking number of weeks, if not months, to create. The fact that a physical location existed containing equipment specified by the composers, some of which was custom-built for them, helped to establish it as a world-class studio where some of the most important work in electronic music was being produced by Berio, Moderna, and others. Process was important and was very evident in their work. Fast forward to today, where many musicians use a laptop as a portable studio. From idea to marketplace follows a very simple chain. There is no division of labor. The focus is on results. The software doesn't get in the way. And you can go from idea to SoundCloud in a very short period of time. The real-time aspect of music production has allowed the software manufacturers to do the thinking for us, tell us which buttons to push, direct our attention for us. Is this really a democratization of technology?
We are feeling some way betrayed, because we have put a lot of efforts in our music, which is much more than simply playing music for something. And even when we make a lot of efforts to, for example, to the glitch music, we will reveal one functioning of what we are expecting. This is more a way a political stance. It's not okay, my precious equipment doesn't work, but it's much, much more. I can understand that. This is why I don't ask you which software you will use. It's true, there is this background, because I think it's a lot of the musicians and the activists that have this kind of...
Maybe it's mine? Yeah. Could be.
I don't know.
That's a glitch.
It's a glitch.
It's a glitch, it's fine.
Yeah, controlling us. So, it's true. because I think that I'm coming from a different background. I'm not really a musician. I'm coming from the so-called industrial sound from the end of the 80s. But some way it's the same feeling. Something is we don't like. Something is wrong. Maybe we pay attention to something that doesn't work. How we expect? And this is the point. So from the other side, this is positive thinking, I think, because you are still thinking, I want to try to change something, or at least I want to say I don't like it. But at the same time, you know, this is a very hard strategy, because it fails regularly, because you can see, we can buy software, we can buy library. I was just speaking with a friend of mine, he's a musician, he's trying to do jazz music in a very open-minded way, but now in order to have some money, he's just preparing some library music, very, very, how to say, mainstream music. It's 80, but you need to eat something. So we are in a strange position, I think. From one side, we are fighting with data. From one side, at the moment, maybe the glitch is something that is already assumed as this is the thing that I have when I see some glitch opera. It's the same place. So I think it's a little bit too late. But now, what can we do next? Do you have some suggestions?
Well, I think that one thing is to get very clear about what a glitch is, and the glitch is just a statistical anomaly, and failure is something that happens statistically. So, you know, an accident, I mean, you can look at actuarial tables in an insurance company and, you know, see that accidents are mathematically very concise and very, very accurate in terms of when and how things go wrong. So one thing that I think can kind of combat, a couple of different things are at issue here. One is, well, okay, where do we take it? And I see, what disturbs me is I see more and more people kind of dumbing down their software, you know, and this is not to speak badly about Ableton Live at all, because I mean, Robert Henke's a friend of mine, and you know, there are some very good pieces that are created with it, so I don't share that friend of mine's view that it's necessarily creating jingles every time you create a piece. But I think building your own software is one way to combat this, and there are so many authoring programs out there that you can use from, and if you want to work on open source platforms, there's PD, many others, I mean, tons of open source software that you can use to author very, very interesting work. So I think that's one way. A, because you're not necessarily looking for a pre-packaged piece of software that's manufactured. And believe me, I worked for 5 years in the software, audio software industry. And so much of software is designed by marketing departments rather than engineers. So you always are suffering from the median under the bell curve of just average people wanting to do average things. And that shifts every year. More and more people want just single button functionality. And once you've done that, then you've taken all possible statistical anomalies or accidents out of the hands of the user. It's made safe. It's like baby-proofing an apartment before you have a baby, right? You make all the sharp edges soft and close off all the gates and of stairways, and so you baby-proof it. And I feel like that's the thing that's really been happening to software over the past 5 to 10 years, is this baby-proofing effect, which I find repulsive personally. I'd much rather build my own software and work with the tools and have them get in the way, because that's what makes you think. This conflict is what's lacking. And the conflict is what creates and allows you to be innovative. So, and taking time. I think taking more time to create a piece, this whole thing of, I can create a track in under 15 minutes, it just, I don't know. I mean, I have yet to hear anything really stunning that was done under 15 minutes. So, and you know, in the past, like when you were working with Music Concrete, it took weeks or months to make a piece, so there was so much variability built into a piece of work. 1 week you might be interested in some aspect of sound, the next week you might be interested in a different aspect of sound, which then shows up in the same piece you're working on. So you give yourself this time for change and evolution and to think things through. So this real-time composition, real-time VJing, real-time this, it's okay for Twitter and on an iPhone, I guess, but for creating art or sound art or electroacoustic music, I think that's a failure, and not in a good way though. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to start with...
I didn't know I had big fans, but...
Anyhow, a glitch. I want to talk about democratization of technology you spoke about before, because you were mentioning how all these buttons hold these people, engineers behind them that tell us what to do and etc. Now, before of that, you were saying that studio, on the other hand, offers you this long-term process and rather not so much achieving of a goal, kind of a working ethics, yeah? So my question is, what about all the engineers in the studio? How does that differ with all the engineers and all the record label people telling you what to do? And plus, keeping your copyright on top of that, I want to ask you, how does that differ? Is it better or worse in your opinion? Because obviously today we have much less time to achieve what we want, and the genres, new genres of music, they come in 5 years and they're gone. But my question is still, obviously there's loads of more producers because we are becoming creative consumers, right? And this is, in a sense, democratization. Now the question is just, like, how do you differ? I mean, even analog equipment, it was also marketing people in the back. They were working with musicians, so the musicians said, okay, we need cutoff and we need the frequency boost, but we don't need all this analog synthesizer stuff that we don't know how to use. So in a sense, the evolution of analog equipment and digital equipment is going pretty much the same way. So I'm asking you, why would you say that this democratization is actually not happening on the end? If there are more and more producers who can finish a finished product at home without taking their copyrights, okay, maybe losing the process of the studio, but the question is the autonomy of the producers more important rather than the workflow in the studio? That would be my question. Thank you.
Wow, there's a lot of interesting things I could address there, but I think the one thing is that a lot of things have changed in the past 30, 40 years, one of which is that analog synthesizers cost a lot of money, and that was a barrier to entry for a lot of people. And then when engineers broke off and started creating kits that people could then afford, like Paya and Aries and all these kit form synthesizers, there was more access to a lot of this equipment. But I'm not saying that the democratization is necessarily a good thing, because it isn't. It's what we've been sold is kind of a hoodwink. You know, we've been had. You know, because the democratization is really more of us being creative consumers than it is about being creative people. You know, that whole software industry, I saw it from the very beginning grow into the monster it is today. Pro Tools started, Sound Designer started, all this, and there were a couple of tools and some plugins started and all that, but it was very limited back then. You had maybe a dozen programs at most in the very beginning for doing MIDI and digital audio. But once they kind of created this market, just through the use of desire and spectacle, and then as this took off and people started creating new genres and new electronic music was formed, the use value changed too. So the democratization happened, and everybody now is a producer, and everybody can make music, and everybody can put their stuff up on SoundCloud, but it's like now we have to turn into basically data mining people. You know, how do you find your way through this tsunami of content? So that's one thing. Another is, I mean, are these people really being creative, right? I mean, if I have Ableton Live and I can make a track in under 15 minutes, is that really me being creative, or is it just me wanting attention, you know? I mean, you have to figure that aspect of it as well. There are a group of people who are truly being creative, and, you know, you've got them as producers, Caribou, Aphex Twin, Artecra, all these people are very creative. But, you know, for every one of these people, there's like a million people on SoundCloud who have derivative content. So we have to be very careful not to just kind of like dumb ourselves down.
But isn't that just a question of style?
Not entirely.
It's not just a question of style, because in the previous industry, it had all these filters that says, oh, we don't like this, this is not good enough, this will never be pop, right? Yep. But this year I visited a really interesting multimedia festival in Romania, and it was this gentleman having a talk, and basically he runs a, he's one of the pioneers of video art, right? And he has this every year video art festival, and he was always himself the jury. Until one year, he decided to send out films to 10 other festival juries to decide which one would be the winner. The problem was, after all these 10 festivals decided for themselves, only one video out of 300 got 3 calls, okay? So only one video got voted for 3 times. All other 300 videos, it was just basically a question of style, a question of who likes what, and what do we like? So basically, it's like the question of what is pop today? I mean, I know it's a general philosophical question, but I'm just saying that there's no way to say that Aphex Twin is an artist. That might be your opinion, while a lot of other opinion, like other people might think, well, maybe he's not. My friend is an artist. He's got music on SoundCloud, so why not?
That makes sense, and that's true up to a point, because you know, it's sort of like you've got two things working in concert. You've got the sort of the obesity, mental obesity taking place within pop music, and yeah, you can say it's a matter of style and taste and all that, but you know, so much of the real time is happening within genres too. You've got electronica styles that come and go, and like you said, in a matter of like minutes, you know. It's so much of what's being produced doesn't have any lasting value, because today the worker is not being reproduced. These people are producing in their bedrooms as a hobby, okay? They haven't struggled on the aesthetic plane, they don't have a background, they don't understand the history of electronic music, they don't have all that. They're not standing on the shoulders of giants. They're standing on the shoulders of midgets. And it's not to detract from them. I mean, you will have a statistical anomaly of somebody who produces like amazing work who doesn't have any of that schooling or background or education. But it's rare. It's very rare. And I think that the better work really does come from understanding what's come before you, studying it, knowing it, and then trashing it, and just kind of innovating on your own. You can't mimic, what I was trying to say was you can't mimic your contemporaries. That's fashion. And that's what we have today, in my opinion. We have mostly fashion, very little art.
If I can add something, because we